The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this spring Monday. We've just got a bit of housekeeping because of the upcoming summertime changes. We've got an earlier 2 p.m. UK, 3 p.m. European time, I think for 2 weeks, and then we're going back to the usual 4 to 6 p.m. slot. Anyway, we've got a great lineup today, apart from the brilliant political editor Basil Valentine, who's back from holiday. We've got the excellent Peter Barnes, a journalist and political expert who knows everything there is to know about Westminster. We've then got Jerome Corsi, a journalist and author who, among his many areas of expertise, knows a lot about the Kennedy assassination and promises perhaps the definitive book based on the latest exposés on that 60-year-old story, the lone gunman story, he thinks, or lone gunman theory is conclusively refuted with his latest book. After the break, in the second hour, we've got David Bell, a WHO official who writes beautifully and will tell us about corruption and bureaucratic overreach on the COVID story. While Professor Patrick Linden thinks we could all live longer and will reveal the latest political developments to help us do so, because it's also a matter of political will and putting money in the right place. So stick around for both hours for a very interesting afternoon. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about Macron, who has promised to send soldiers to Russia, or Ukraine rather, and an event that might trigger World War III, judging by Putin's response to that. He doesn't seem to have a lot of support from some countries, but others, even Finland and maybe even Sweden, have said maybe. And I mean, I think it's going to end up devastating for all of us if that happens. I think red lines will be crossed and there will be big clashes. So why is Macron changed from being the pussycat of Europe, the guy who wanted to talk to Putin until the end, and then the biggest hawk in Europe? Well, I'm going to actually return to this story about his wife, Brigitte Macron, and the sexual shenanigans or the sexual scandals that are transgender scandals that are going on in France at the moment. I just want to tell you that, you know, Candace Owens, who's a very well-known podcaster and blogger, she came out a few days ago with a story, and she's going to stake her career on it, that Brigitte Macron is actually a man who changed sex 30 years ago, and she has some evidence to back it up based on the French-speaking press, and I'm just going to run through that. I'm telling you, I can't say for certain, and I've been reading the French stuff, and unlike the mainstream media, I won't bury a retraction deep at the end of my 2 hours or something. I'll come right up front with it. But the potential, the importance of Macron at the moment is so high that it's worth talking about. I mean, let's not forget that for three or four years, the American media awarded each other Pulitzer Prizes on the fake claims that Trump was a Russian agent and was influenced by their blackmail. And that was debunked I forget the guy's name, the FBI, former FBI chief. He came out, he was selected by the Democrats, and he said, no, it wasn't true. But still, I mean, every day the New York Times was coming out with 10 stories a day on this topic. So let us at least devote 10 minutes to this story. And that is that Brigitte Macron changed sex when she was about 30, from being a man to being a woman. And the evidence, the very suspicious thing going on is the fact that there are no photographs, apparently, of her under 30. And she had three children who look like her, but the conspiracy theorists, I'll call them that, say that they were created when she was a man with another woman who does look like her. So although she's officially the mother, she's actually the father. Okay. Now, there's a photo of her, her family, the Trogner family, the family of chocolatiers, when they were young in the 1950s, and there's a boy there called Jean-Michel, who looks very much like Brigitte. And you know, you have this AI software apparently coming from China, not that that's probably relevant, that exactly measures, you know, things like dimples, which don't change, and nose size and eyes and things like that. And it does, you could tell even now. And the girl that's supposed to be Brigitte Macron doesn't look like her at all. She's a younger girl. So what the skeptics in France are saying is, Brigitte, show us pictures of when you were pregnant. Show us a picture of when you were under 30. Show us a picture of you with your family when you were young. Show us a picture with your brother, because the brother disappeared at about the same time as Brigitte came on the scene. So is Brigitte really her brother? I mean, it's really incredible. I can advise you to go to Candace Owens on YouTube just for a 15-minute rundown of the story. I mean, she's convinced by it, and it's always worth checking out. Now, the point is, Trump has been, according to Rolling Stone magazine, which is talking to White House officials, brought with him after he left the office information about Macron's strange sexual habits. And it's a long article. Just Google Rolling Stone Trump Macron. And he kept the papers there, and he's been joking to friends about it, you know, in his Trumpian way. And so the strong version of the story is that Macron is gay, and he has a transgendered boyfriend, come girlfriend, Brigitte Macron. And the weak version of the story is that he has strange sexual habits. And that's that Trump says that, and it's confirmed by people who work for the White House that those papers are circulating. Now, the point is, the upshot of this, and then Trump, Macron has been seen with gay types, you know, sort of in tutus and black dancers and things like that. And people have been joking about that for years. And he's a kind of strange, you know, well, he's homosexual or bisexual if his woman really is a wife. Anyway, are these rumors circulating in Moscow as well? Has the Kremlin been spreading this stuff? Do the Russians know more than they're letting on? And are they prepared to drop a truth bomb on Macron? Is MI6 or CIA prepared to drop a truth bomb on Macron and said, unless you go to war with Russia, we'll destroy your presidency? Candace Owens says the world is run by blackmail. And you can't exclude that on an extremely important issue like World War III, that he is being pushed by forces that we don't know about regarding his sexuality. I mean, look at his face when he's talking. He's a man, obviously, in a very high state of tension. Maybe he's taken drugs or something. Anyway, I'll feed you those developments, and I'll try and talk to some of the French journalists who've been following this story for a couple of years. But we're going to go into a quick break now, and we'll have our news political editor, Basil Valentine, with us after a quick break. This is TNT Radio.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, Basil, political editor. What have you got? What do you make of that story, by the way? Do you think there's any truth to it?
Well, the way you laid it out there, Pelle, I certainly don't have the information at hand to comprehensively deny it. Put it that way. Where is this brother? What's the official story of what happened to him?
Exactly.
Why are there no photographs of Brigitte Macron, as you say, aged under 30, or pregnant, or anything else? You know, the whole thing could be dealt with very quickly if that sort of evidence was produced. Brigitte also, rather like Michelle Obama, about whom there are identical rumours. Affects a kind of feminine poise, shall we say, and hairstyle that is sometimes associated with transsexuals rather than with natural born women. Do you follow me, Pelle?
Yeah, I haven't bothered that.
In other words, the long hair which frames the face like this, is something that transsexuals and transvestites do in order to look more feminine, because if they had short hair, then more masculine features would be exposed. So I'm not for one moment saying that Brigitte Macron started life as a man. I'm simply saying that Candace Owens is actually a serious commentator, regular with Tucker Carlson and Fox. She's a very intelligent woman.
And she is, I was impressed.
Yeah, for her to sort of stake her entire reputation and her career on this story is highly unusual, let's put it that way. And then you've got the Trump dimension as well. Perhaps he knows more than he's letting on. And then finally, as you said, the world is run by blackmail. Now, that's something that conspiracy theorists have been saying for a long time, combination of blackmail and bribery. And it brings us neatly onto my other subject, which is that of the Middle East, where we have to wonder why Western politicians have sat idly by and watched people being deliberately starved to death. The latest report has come out from a UN accredited body talking about the abysmal catastrophe unfolding in Gaza. This is the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, which has said that 70% of the population faces IPC Phase 5. Now, these organizations are very particular about nutrition and how to measure access to nutrition, etc. And Phase 5 is famine. So that's where we are. Joseph Borrell, of course, the European diplomatic chief, has said exactly the same thing. And he was pilloried as a result. Ilon Levy, the Israeli spokesman, insisted on social media that Israel is facilitating the delivery of unlimited quantities of aid by air, land and sea. I would say that Mr. Levy is lying.
Well, why do you think, I mean, how can Netanyahu get away with challenging Biden like this? I mean, what's I mean, you just to pick up on the theme of blackmail, who has holds on whom?
Well, you know, the whole Epstein thing was beneath the surface, possibly about Epstein filming wealthy and powerful people on behalf of the Mossad, and then using the tapes to blackmail them into going along with his agenda. Simple as that.
All right.
We don't know if that's the case. Yep. That's, you know, that's never come to light. We still don't have the full Epstein client list. But, you know, when you look at the supine way in which politicians in Brussels, Washington, above all, where we know that AIPAC bribes scores of congressmen and senators to do Israel's bidding, and the donations as well to, for example, Keir Starmer from wealthy Zionist backers in his campaign to become leader of the Labour Party. We know that there's a lot of bribery that takes place. So a lot of it sort of supposedly official bribery, campaign contributions and all that. We don't know about the blackmail going on beneath the surface.
Well, I think, I mean, I see myself as, or we are doing a kind of public service because we're trying to expose, I mean, people pull a lever when they make a vote and expect things to happen, like less immigration or more money for the working class or whatever, and it never happens. And you have to ask, people ask themselves why. And if they know what how it really goes on, maybe the politics is a theater, that newspapers lie all the time. They're in hoc, they're in friends with the people they're supposed to be covering. Half of them work, some of them work for the intelligence agencies. Intelligence agencies, powerful donors. I mean, you just have to read that essay by what's his name, that guy from the, in the 1960s who was famous, who wrote about it's the guy who was who wrote about linguistics as well, Noam Chomsky. I mean, I find I never identified myself as a left winger, but I think the left winger's analysis of power actually is a good one, so you've got to stick with that. And he talked about powerful donors, powerful owners like the Murdochs, and then intelligence agencies, and then ideology, and all these things are filters that design that control what you're saying and what the media says and what you're supposed to believe.
Absolutely.
And of course, if you're inside the bubble, you can never talk about these things because then you're out within 5 seconds. You know, so people don't talk about it. But think blackmail. I'm not 100%, but I mean, it's a possibility. We're allowed to air possibilities without having all the evidence in, you know, but it's like a research program that we're going to look into if we're studying politics.
Well, absolutely, blackmail. Particularly when the evidence on the ground is so obvious, you know. The ICJ have said there's a plausible case for genocide in Gaza. That should mean all the stops are pulled out. diplomatically around the world. That should mean that the country committing genocide is isolated diplomatically.
That's right.
You know, we've got this strange dichotomy in the European Union at the moment where Josep Borrell, the EU foreign minister, has said that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. That's the same. He represents the same European Union that projected the Israeli flag all over its headquarters building in Brussels. Would they do so again now, Pelle? What does von der Leyen have to say about starvation being used as a weapon of war? Is she
Meanwhile, this country is allowed into the Eurovision Song Contest, you know, while Russians get their cars confiscated if they drive inside the EU, you know. And
double standards there are absolutely. Yeah.
And the global South sees this, you know, but we Europeans don't see it. Yes. And we're supposed to be so superior and moral about it.
Yeah, some of us see it, fortunately.
Anyway, Basil, we'll come back to you in the next hour with more of an update, I think, on the Russian elections. But for the moment, we're just going to go into a quick break. And then we've got our first guest. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT Radio.
TNT's Mark Morano.
And there's a whole history of this idea that the establishment, the powers that be, the regime in power, likes the idea of a little eco-terrorism to keep the population hungry. I mean, if you think about it, their policies, government policies of the Great Reset, net zero climate agenda, are quite literally eco-terrorism or a form of terrorism. It's, as Jesse Jackson used to say, it's economic violence, it's economic terrorism. Jesse Jackson used to say that about the Reagan administration. But in this case, it's the intentional collapse of energy, food, transportation, free speech, all to achieve and make us safer and give them more power under the auspices, if you will, of a crisis.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats.
It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom. And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Without CO2, the world stops breathing. CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We've got with us Peter Barnes, who's a political campaigner, campaigns director, conservative commentator, and having been a member of the Conservative Party for over a decade, he's worked in a variety of election campaigns from leadership to locals, general elections and referenda. He's a regular guest and speaker on a number of podcasts, TV and radio shows, including Talk TV's That Was the Woke That Was. Peter knows the ins and outs of the Westminster bubble like no one else and ruffles feathers when needed to be ruffled. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
I'm sort of an outsider. I used to live in the UK nearly all my life, yeah. But I've spent the last few years in Sweden. So it gives me an outside perspective, which can be useful sometimes, because you say, what's going on in the UK? You know, I don't follow the news as closely. You're living inside it.
Yeah.
So I think what a lot of Swedes are kind of half informed would say something like, you know, how's this Brexit thing going? Because you were supposed to have free trade agreements. And people on my side of the aisle, as it were, say, well, you know, Britain is always the country of freedom, and that's why you broke out of the EU, which is run by continental bureaucrats who never know freedom in their lives and all that. And then immigration, of course, you know, you were all worried about that, especially the working class in the north. But now you've got record immigration, record woke, which you're exporting to the rest of the world. You haven't got any free trade agreements. You've still got these productivity problems and all the rest of it. and incompetent elites when you were supposed to have statesmanship and brilliant leaders. What's going on? What happened?
Do you know, I think you hit the nail on the head with that final comment. Incompetent elites. I think we, after Brexit, we got a significant amount of power back, and we gave it to arguably the most incompetent group of people I've ever had to work with in my entire professional life. They are useless. You know, Brexit was a great moment. I have always believed that Britain could have rewrote its own history, that it had a great thing to break away from the EU, which is a dying institution. The Eurozone is on the brink of collapse pretty much every other day. And, you know, Britain has always been one of those stalwart countries. And yet I kind of look back over the last 15 to 20 years and I'm like, what has actually happened here? And I put it all down to complete and utter incompetence. We have gone from statesmen like Winston Churchill to Sadiq Khan. If you the decline of the country can literally be tracked by the decline of the competency of our politicians.
And it seems that these people don't have much experience. So, I mean, my political memory stretches back to the 1980s when I remember you had people like who'd been in politics for decades before becoming foreign ministers. And then you have Rishi Sunak, who got into parliament a few years ago and is foreign secretary within a very short time, you know, and that seems wrong somehow.
Well, you have to remember that Rishi Sunak became chancellor because Boris Johnson needed somebody in the in number 11 to who he could, end quote, control. I wonder how well that one worked out for him.
Right.
One of the biggest problems I have is that you just get a lot of people that feel like, well, going into politics is what they're supposed to do. You know, you've earned your money in the city, so therefore you move into the politics space. We don't really have that many kind of dedicated public servants anymore. People who actually want to make things better. We have people who just feel the need that that's what they're supposed to do. And I say that right across the political spectrum. I say it about people on the left and on the right. You know, a lot of people over here have a great admiration for Nigel Farage, for example. But for me, Nigel Farage is nothing but a grifter. I sit very firmly on his side of the aisle. But I don't believe he's as invested in the country as many people make him out to be. I do think we have to start being honest about what these politicians are doing and in whose name they're doing it. You know, you mentioned the kind of the woke stuff. I'd literally spent my life talking about woke politics. And this is being brought in from the left, right, from the left wing and from the right wing. You know, it is one of these things that, you know, I think the issue used the phrase omni-party. Well, that is Britain now. We are an omni-party state. You know, we criticize the likes of Russia for being a one-party state. If you could tell me the difference between the two main parties, you know, you're doing better than I can. And I spend my time in Westminster.
Well, I was wondering whether, I mean, I had an interesting discussion with a guy who works for the UN who said that, you know, in third world, in developing countries where they interpreters get high salaries, that actually they get salaries higher than government ministers in those countries. So everyone becomes a interpreter for the UN. So it's like, can you imagine if somebody came from Mars and gave you a salary of $10 million, then everyone would work for the Martians, right? Well, hasn't the City of London had that effect, right? Because in my generation, everyone went into the city and we had lived in a post-Cold War world where politics, there were no battles to be fought and everything was running itself. So everyone smart went into working, you know, 1 millisecond faster than your rival at getting this or that financial deal done. I mean, where what's the social I mean, that's an argument from the left, which I've taken on board, you know. So all good people went into the City of London and only the losers went into politics, especially when you had all this coverage of all your private life and everything. You don't want to do that, really.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've seen some of the abuse that members of parliament get now, like in their inboxes and through their tweets and stuff. And I'm like, what sensible person would ever put themselves through that? And more importantly, what sensible person would put their family through that? I think there's a member of parliament here, and his wife and young daughter, who's only 5 years old, was followed in two different cars just because the MP had happened to vote a particular way. I think it's absolutely perverse the way that some people treat politicians. But the one thing I will say is over here in the UK, we have this feeling of politicians should be beaten down, that they shouldn't be paid very much. So they're paid here on average about £84,000. I actually think if you want to attract the top talent out of places like the city, out of business, out of this, you've got to pay them. You know, why on earth would you give up your privacy, a nice comfy salary, a nice corner suite office at a C-suite firm, and to then be called all the names under the sun? You know, you've got to have a little bit of give and take here. And sadly, in this country for a long time, we like to see our politicians live as though they're basically refugees on the street. And I think that has to change.
And it also seems to be, I mean, but it didn't, politicians used to have a real job, you know, so yes. They do that in the mornings, and then they could, and that kept them in touch, they kept them sort of independent of the party machine.
Yes. And oh, 100%. Yes. There's a great story.
And now we have these professional politicians. And I see that when I think about Europe and Brussels.
Oh,
what the hell do these ministers go? All they know is the inside of a limousine and their pals when they meet up for these Euro meetings. Which is why they all think the same. You know,
it's funny. I've got two really good stories. One about MPs being in touch. Now, this was when Theresa May was prime minister. She was at a UN meeting to deal with something to do with China. And the very next day, she was judging who grew the largest turnip in her constituency. You know, right. It was a great moment of kind of humbling a politician. And I do like how we sometimes do that. But it's interesting you say about these politicians not knowing anything, what's going on. A very, very good friend of mine used to be a staffer to a kind of mid-ranked Conservative Member of Parliament. And she always used to say, oh, I'll come and meet you to talk about this. I've just got to go drop him off at the House of Commons and then I'll come deal with it. And, you know, and it really struck me. It's the way that she felt like she was the one actually doing the work. The MP just seemed to be the one to say, go vote that way. And that one, I did kind of find it funny, but two, I found it greatly concerning that this member of Parliament didn't really know what he was doing at all.
Wow. Okay, Peter, we're just going to go into a quick news break and we'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. Thank you very much. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio News.
Get the news.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Vladimir Putin looks set to extend his nearly quarter century rule over Russia after winning this year's presidential election by a landslide. After severing ties with France, the West African nation of Niger is now ending all military cooperation with the US, effective immediately. And Finland says all options must remain on the table when it comes to sending NATO troops to Ukraine.
On air
and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Peter Barnes with us, who's a political campaigns director and a commentator on many TV shows and knows everything about what's going on in Westminster. We're talking about UK politics at the moment.
Yeah.
We've got 10 minutes, so I'd love to talk to you longer, but we've got this mass immigration going on to me, it seems like a lot of the Brexit vote, some of it was we want our freedom, fair enough, but some of it, the less pure motive, but no less true, was to limit immigration because people were losing their country, they felt. But I mean, the Tories have maxed that out. I mean, that's incredible. How did they do that?
Well, everybody always kind of, I think the Tories exacerbated a problem that already existed. The reality was the great majority of our immigration before Brexit actually came from outside of the EU. It came from places like India, Pakistan, and kind of that bit of the world. And the idea that Brexit was going to limit it, I think it was a strong argument there. And I think it was right that was an area for the Brexit campaign to go after. But again, I look at kind of the measures that we've taken as a nation to kind of limit immigration haven't been effective. And more importantly, they have been fighting this battle with one hand tied behind their back. They're not willing to say, do you know what? Maybe some of the people coming here shouldn't be in this country. There seems to be this kind of everybody's a victim mentality. And that is a really dangerous way of kind of running our immigration system, because a lot of it is illegal immigration now. That's one thing that Brexit has really blown the doors off. You know, we have these kind of small boats that come across the English Channel and they dock. Most of them collapse halfway across the channel. And, you know, they get picked up by either the Navy or the local lifeboat service and get brought back here. And they're given hotel rooms to stay in and money to live off and all the rest of it. And they claim that they're asylum seekers. This is the real problem of our immigration argument, is that it has been kind of expanded to deal with our failed asylum system and our failed, just all of it's just a complete failure, really.
It's interesting, though, that, I mean, what's the push factor? I mean, how do they get to Europe? Is it because is it easier for them to cross? I mean, what's...
Yeah, so basically what seems to happen is that a lot of it is organized by criminal gangs, and it's people smuggling, basically. That's to be all and end all of it. And what's happening is that they are being offered to take out a loan of about £5,000 to £7,000, and these people will literally put you on one of these little rickety boat things and ship you across. They'll tell you how to kind of cheat the system, and then you kind of work the debt off once you get into the United Kingdom. It's basically slave trafficking, and it's abhorrent. You know, some of the stories that we've heard over here about people who have had to pay tens of thousands of pounds, it is quite abhorrent. But what concerns me greatly is, you know, again, we're not willing to say that this isn't a good thing. You know, we're not willing that there's a certain section of our society that's saying, do you know what? Well, we have to welcome everybody and all. And despite the fact that we could be welcoming anybody into this country right now, under the current system that we've got, anybody could get in. And I think it is a national security issue that is not being talked about with the seriousness that it deserves. You know, we've got everybody wanting to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Well, I'd hate to break this to you. The world isn't full of people that want to do that.
The only party that seems to be talking about this then is the Reform Party, which is the sort of post-Nigel Farage party, which he seems to be controlling from behind the scenes. But they're not going to get any seats right. But you're quite in favour of the Westminster system, but it doesn't seem to be representing the public will in this particular regard. Because
I think this is the thing. I think the Westminster system works. The party system doesn't. One of the bigger problems that we have in the United Kingdom is our political parties are too big. So if we take the Conservative Party, for example, you've got figures like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who sit very firmly on the right, and you had people like Theresa May, who sit a little bit more to the left. And because of this kind of broad church, as they call it, or I think in the Labour Party, they call it big tent, you're getting a real mix of people. And because of that, you're getting really watered down policies, and you're getting kind of mixed messages from certain people within those parties. So whilst Reform, yes, are focused very firmly on this issue of immigration, because of our kind of first past the system, most votes wins kind of way of doing things, they're not going to get a single seat at the next general election. They currently have one, which is Lee Anderson, who has crossed the floor, so he's not been elected in, but you know, he's on track just to lose his seat, because what is happening is that the Reform Party are splitting the right-wing vote of this country. So in the same way that the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats split their vote, the Conservatives are now splitting their own vote as well.
But I mean, if let's say the Reform Party didn't exist or chose not to stand in Tory seats, so the Tories, I don't know how many seats they would get then. But I mean, they're still so pro-immigration, it seems. It wouldn't make any difference. Is there an anti-immigration section of the Conservative Party?
Yes, there is, and it is growing, and it's getting more control. The problem is there is still a significant amount of the more kind of what we call one nation conservative. A kind of lefty namby-pamby. Margaret Thatcher used to call them the wets, and she used to kind of denigrate them, saying they don't really stand for anything. They just want to be nice people. But unfortunately, these are tough issues, and I don't think they've got the stones to be able to tackle these issues strongly enough. And it's not really anti-immigration. It's more a controlled immigration stance, which is what the Conservative Party, which I'm a member of, I would like to see it take. Is growing and it's getting there, but it's not coming up with sensible and workable policies. That wing of the party is basically the kind of Boris Johnson era that we've had since about 2019. They got given the keys to the car and they kind of drove the car off the cliff. So despite the fact that many people keep saying, oh, well, we've had all the right wingers in. And my point is they haven't done anything. They've done even less than the people that we don't like.
It's interesting. I talked to a lot of Americans on this show and some Brits, but fewer. And it's interesting to see how America and Britain have diverged, because America really has got a rebel movement that's very strong on immigration. And it's going to take down the deep state. And there's a Trump Heritage Foundation is getting interviewing thousands of people who are going to deep state, meaning both intelligence services and the pro-Democrat Justice Department, all the rest of it. Because Trump realizes he's got to do that. But Britain doesn't have, it's almost like the Brexiteers still don't have that, is it Trump figure or Trump movement?
This has been a problem on the right of politics, really since, it has been longer than I've been involved. And it's mainly because it's not organized enough. If you look at America, you've got the Heritage Foundation, you've got all these organizations that they know how to put a movement together. The right in the United Kingdom doesn't really know how to do that. It's floundering. You obviously have key figures like Nigel Farage. You've got the Reform Party. You've got certain people in the Conservative Party. But unfortunately, they all don't seem to get along very well. So because of that, you've got a bucking of egos, you've got people trying to vie for political power, and any kind of movement is kind of falling apart. Even if you look at the Brexit referendum, there were two different campaigns. They didn't work together, and they couldn't stand each other. Both said that they were going to be the reason they would lose. So even if you go back, the right in the United Kingdom, whilst agreeing in principle, can't work together. And because of that, it allows the left, not just the, like the left of the Conservative Party, but the left wing in general, to really take control of political power, because the right simply can't get his trousers on before he's out the door.
Peter, we've only got a minute left, but I want to talk to you much longer, but let's just have a quick question, I think. Do you think that, does this right, the Reform Party, do they actually like Trump, or do they feel the same like most Brits, that they feel contempt and dislike him?
I don't think they dislike him. I don't think they care about him. I think they'll use him as a political kind of tool to get elected, saying like, look, we like this guy, this is our kind of thing. But in the United Kingdom, we don't like the whole kind of vitriolic kind of name-calling kind of politics. Right. So I think they'll step away from that. But yeah, I think they do. I think they're rather indifferent to Trump.
And what about RFK? Final question.
Yes, I think most people in the United Kingdom have absolutely no idea who he is.
Right. Okay, Peter Barnes, thank you very much. A brilliant conservative political commentator. Love to have you on again. We'll talk more about UK politics another time. Thank you very much. This is TNT Radio. We're getting into a quick break. Thanks, Peter.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mama a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, thank you.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with Elaine.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Internet crimes against children in New Mexico are real. And when it comes to protecting your children, the New Mexico AG's office and the ICAC unit are on the front lines. I'm New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas. There's nowhere to hide for online predators in New Mexico. We are working tirelessly using state-of-the-art technology and resources to seek out and find them wherever they are. Please talk to your children about the dangers that exist online, social media, games, and messenger apps. It's always important to know who you're talking to.
Help fight online predators in New Mexico by submitting a tip today.
Discussing national and international issues, you're listening to Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show. We've got a wonderful guest with us who's going to talk to me about one of my favorite subjects, the Kennedy assassination. Now, the Kennedy assassination is more important than just historical event 60 years ago. I think it's like a gateway to becoming red-pilled about how the world actually works in terms of assassinations, in terms of government and media cover-ups. And if people get red-pilled or get the truth about this, it'll open their minds about corruption and bad things happening today. So Dr. Jerome Corsi is one of the top writers on this topic. He's brilliant. I've read several of his books. He received his PhD from Harvard University's Department of Government in 72. From 72 to 82, he worked as a university professor. He's finally faculty appointments at the University of New Mexico and subsequently at the University of Denver. He is a great polemicist and writer, and I recommend you search out his work on the internet. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the final analysis, which he's written with David Mantic, presents, in his words, indisputable forensic evidence that two shots fired from the front and one shot fired from the rear killed the president in a Dealey Plaza crossfire. Welcome to the show, Jerome. So what is this final evidence that shows that he was killed from the front, from this place called the Grassy Knoll, which I've talked about before?
Well, the book I've written with David Mantic, it's a 564-page book. It's a long book. David Mantic is a a PhD in physics and also has an MD. He's a radiation oncologist. So he's spent 40 years, more than 40 years, reading x-rays for cancer patients. Now, he studied the x-rays of the JFK skull in the National Archives. There's three x-rays. He's seen them more than anyone else, nine times, and he's been writing about it for 30 years. I've decided to collaborate with him so I can take his physics and make it understandable to the common reader, to the average person. Yeah. And the distinction of this book is scientific data. Dr. Mandick did optical density measurements of the x-rays. Now, that means he used a densitometer, which is a scientific tool. As a lever, you push it down and a beam of light comes through. It illuminates the x-ray and measures on a logarithmic scale just how much light comes through the x-ray. Now, that permits you to know what you're looking at, whether it's bone or whether there's no tissue there at all or what tissue it is. And the other thing is that it's like if you had buildings that were impossibly tall. If there's too much light, it goes over the scale of, say, on a logarithm, the scale is about 0.5 to about 4.0. If you've got something that's registering 6 or 7 and luminosity, it's just impossibly bright. So that's forged. Now, the three x-rays all have been altered. They're not the originals. They were all altered to cover up evidence of frontal shots. Mm-hmm. And even on the cover, where I'm showing the three shots mm-hmm. that were fired, one was fired to the right front. It hit at the hairline. And you can actually see the bullet fragments going back through the upper quadrant of the head. Appears mm-hmm. to have been a mercury bullet because those fragments couldn't be removed. The largest of the bullet fragments is at the back at the head, and it did not exit. And at the front, there's a lot of small little particles where a bullet entered the head and it first broke up. That's clear evidence of a frontal shot. Mm-hmm. Another frontal shot occurred here on the right front. It can be seen clearly in the x-rays because it created a keyhole entry point, which is indicative of an oblique or tangential shot that went mm-hmm. across just the part of the head to blow out the back. Didn't go mm-hmm. through the head squarely. It went through on the side angle, entering mm-hmm. here, coming out, big blowout in the back. Mm-hmm. And the third shot was at the back of the head, right at the knob of the back of the head at a low angle. Mm-hmm. So first, none of these shots were fired from the Texas School Book Depository. The mm-hmm. likelihood is that one, maybe two, came from the grassy knoll. There's also a bullet hole in the windshield of the car, which we fully documented, that came from the other side of the grassy knoll, the south side, by the railroad bridge, where there was a shooter up at the railroad bridge that overlooked the triple underpass, and a third shooter from behind in the Daltex building, most likely, shooting at a low angle. But these optical density measurements are science. In other words, mm-hmm. you can see the missing parts of the x-ray. You can see, you know, the back Harper fragment where it exploded out. Mm-hmm. And the masking, there's a big white patch at the back of the head on the lateral x-rays. They're trying to block out the damage done back there and draw your attention to the front of the head, where, again, there was surgery done before the mm-hmm. autopsy. And this part of the head was all destroyed to mask the evidence of the frontal shot, to make it look like there was a big blowout of the front of the head from a back shot.
Can I just interrupt briefly?
Said only one shot. Yeah, the Warren Commission said only one shot, and they were wrong.
What you I believe all that. I'll just do some sort of fill me in type questions, because I'm sure an intelligent audience yes. would ask those questions as well. But there were guys on the sixth floor of the tech, but they just missed. Is that right?
Well, it's not for sure there were any shots fired for the sixth floor. There's some evidence suggesting it was, but there were shots that missed, and they right. could easily have been fired from the sixth floor.
One, right, because there were witness testimonies yes. of people standing there, but nothing tying Oswald to that at all, anyway.
No, that's no. right.
But when you're saying there's a bright, and when you hold up your book, maybe you can hold it up again, your book.
Yes. Yes.
Right. I can see the head there, and there's a bright white space. Now, yes. was that a doctoring of the actual X-ray, or was it a doctoring of the brain? Because what I heard, you can put the book down. It's okay. I don't want to confuse things, but I think I read one of Mantic's books before, and I've read, I don't know, the David Lifton book, whatever his name is, which suggested that they replaced the brain with something. I mean, so JFK had this destroyed brain, and they took that out, and they put a new brain in, and that was hardly damaged at all, and that confused things. But
yes,
just let's not confuse things too much. You're saying that that white spot, that white brain, is that an part of the X-ray? A remodeling of the X-ray, or was it actually the brain itself?
It's a remodeling of the X-ray. It's a photograph of the X-ray that was blasted with light at that point. So in other words, it was a attempt to get that to be exceptionally white. Okay,
because they
blocked the light is what they really did to make it appear whiter in the X-ray.
Right,
because X-ray is a negative. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So, and secondly, to answer your question about the two brains, we cover that in the book. They did the initial autopsy. They looked at the brain, but the brain had been altered by pre-autopsy surgery, which the JFK's body had been kind of smuggled into the autopsy anteroom before the official autopsy, and the doctors altered the wounds to look like they were all from the back. So they destroyed a lot of the tissue of the brain. A second brain autopsy was done with a brain that was not Kennedy's, which they made to look like a shot hit in the back and furrowed and blew out through the front of the head. So they had an altered brain that wasn't Kennedy's, that was a second brain operation. But what you're seeing on the cover of the book is an altered X-ray.
Okay. And was Mantic, you knew, working from that altered X-ray, or you were working from other X-rays or photographs?
There are three X-rays that are critical. Right. There are two lateral. One was taken, the left side of the head was down, and the right side of the head was down. The X-ray was taken through the side of the head, and there's one through the front. Now, in the frontal X-ray, there is an object placed that looks like a 6.5 millimeter shot that was was placed in the X-ray and a duplication of the X-ray. But it's only in the shot of the X-ray from the front to the back. It's not in the lateral X-rays. So whoever did it forgot to make it a real object. They just inserted this little mask in there to make it look like there was a 6.5 millimeter bullet, which isn't there in the original.
So, and in fact, that 6.5 millimeter is what the supposed rifle from Oswald, which was probably placed there and found later, but which can't be tied to the assassination, but can be tied to Oswald, because he had a rifle like that, which he was taking pot shots with.
Well,
even
that's unquestionable, because the mail order rifle was never necessarily picked up by Oswald. There's no indication he picked it up. And the original rifle that was found in the initial minutes after the assassination was a Mauser, which disappeared. It was reported it was a Mauser, and suddenly it became a Mannlicher Carcano. But the key distinguishing evidence here is you can clearly see the bullet trail from the shot that entered the forehead. You can clearly see the entry point of the wound from the temple shot. And there's ample evidence at Parkland Hospital that the doctors saw only frontal shots. The back of the head blowout was so massive that everyone in the operating room, the trauma room one at Parkland Hospital, they all say it was this part of the head. There's photographs of the people who were there and the medical personnel saying the back of the head was blown out. But yet that got erased at the autopsy, and it got changed with the pre-autopsy surgery. So there's a disconnect between what was seen at Parkland right after the assassination, frontal shots. What was reported at the autopsy was one shot from behind.
Exactly. And I remember that. I mean, there was a famous book in 1992, just remind me of the name of that guy. And he said, well, we all saw a doctor, and he was in the 1988 documentary.
Dr. Crenshaw.
And they were all saying, I remember reading his memoirs, and they were either told to shut up, and they felt very intimidated by the Secret Service men coming in. And basically, it was taken to Washington and then patched up. I said the back of Kennedy's was matched. Because entry wound is always smaller than the exit wound. So the entry wound was taken to be from the back, and that Kennedy's hair was restored. So they took some photographs of him with a full head of hair at the back. But in actual fact, all that had been blown out.
All that was
so
blown
it was shot
out,
from the front or front left, front right. Yes. Yeah. So the kill shot was from in front, so not from behind.
Yes. Kill shots were from the grassy knoll and probably from the shooter on the other side by the railroad, the triple underpass. But the back shot was also probably a fatal shot. It was just low angle. It was not shot from the Texas School Book Depository's sixth floor.
Right. Could you, all this is totally convincing. And you and Mantic were just working from those three X-rays that have been sitting there. Were they recently declassified? Because the question is, why did it take 40 years? I don't know when Mantic started working on this. All these decades before this astonishingly revelatory X-rays and they became public.
Well, Mantic has been publishing this for 30 years in various forms, but he's a brilliant man. And he's so brilliant that he gives you all the physics. And the physics just go over everybody's head. So what I've done in co-authoring this with him is to, yes, we have the physics in appendices, but I'm explaining in the text what happened. And we have ample illustrations. We're illustrating everything. Mm. We've got illustrations throughout the book. So that when we talk about something, we show it to you. For instance, here is the picture of the second brain. We have that from, so that's the second brain that was a second brain examination. This is my second book on JFK's assassination. My first one was Who Really Killed JFK. It was published 10 years ago and it's done quite well. So I've studied this extensively, but David Mantic did the original work. He's extremely well known in the JFK research community. And he's considered one of the most highly respected researchers. He's been on almost all the DVDs. He's on the most recent Oliver Stone, JFK Revisited. And his work was duplicated by Dr. Michael Chesser, who independently took optical density measurements of the X-rays and came out to the same conclusions. It's very convincing.
I read Mantic's book, and I've read, I think, Gerald Horn. I've seen some of the talks there, and I have to admit, it went over my head slightly. I mean, it was convincing. Yes. I know you're a very good popularizing writer and a very good writer. So I can recommend, on the basis of this, that people read this book because it's sure to explain it in much more detail and convincing detail than we can talk about over a 20-minute interview. Well, let's just shift the terrain a little bit. Dr. Corsi, do you have any thoughts? I mean, these are far more kill teams than even people like myself. I thought there were two, but you're saying there are three or four, by the sounds of it. Do you have any candidates for who it might be then?
I do, but I think that the real story here is that this was a coup d'etat, and it was a fundamental game changer because the government started lying from the moments of the shooting. When the limousine came into Parkland, immediately the Secret Service kept people away from it because there was a bullet hole in the windshield, and they started washing down the blood in the back of the limousine, which is a crime scene. So from the very beginning, the Secret Service was actively involved in a cover-up, and that's critical. Within minutes, there was an announcement of Lee Harvey Oswald was the suspect. In fact, this was published worldwide within minutes of the assassination. Mm. So it was a setup from the very beginning. And one of the other things is we go to the testimony of people who were there. For instance, this officer Hargis, who was riding the motorcycle right to the left of Kennedy to the rear, was splattered by the blood, brain, and tissue that came off of this shot that blew out the back of JFK's hair and head.
Yeah.
And that picture you're talking about, the autopsy, which shows this little tiny red spot where the bullet was supposed to have entered, that is a doctored photograph as well. That hair is drawn in. Again, if the Kennedy assassination was a coup d'etat, that the government planned to get rid of JFK, they shot him in open daylight, and you have now the Pentagon, the CIA, Department of Justice, the FBI, the Secret Service, the mainstream media. This is a massive created event. It's like a Matrix or a Truman Show, you know, the movie, the Truman Show, where the actors think they're living real life, but there's really stage managers that, and the other actors, except for one or two, are actors acting out a script. So we're in a constructed reality. If the CIA can kill a president, lie for 60 years and get away with it, with the mainstream media's cooperation, we have a government narrative that we probably have not had a legitimately elected president except from John Kennedy, because all of these elections now, we have to suspect government interference. How many staged events have we experienced? A pandemic, which, you know, was a bad flu, vaccinations, which appear to be killing people. We can look at 9/11. We can look at a lot of different things. Buildings don't just collapse on their own foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Corsi, we've got to wind up there. We could have you on for another hour easily, but we will have to finalize. We're just going to, Dr. Jerome Corsi and David Mantic wrote The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, The Final Analysis, which you can find in all the bookstores and on Amazon, and I highly recommend you have a look at it. Thank you very much, Dr. Jerome Corsi, talking about the coup d'etat in 1963 and how everything since has been staged. Maybe. Anyway, we're going to go into our second hour and a quick break now for the news. This is TNT Radio.